This is doing a follow-up interview with Bernie Burke at NASA Ames on 22nd September 1981. Well, last time we discussed the actual discovery of Jupiter, in which you established that even then it had a steep spectrum because you knew it was much stronger at one frequency than another, and that it was burst-like and so forth. But then you did quite a bit of follow-up for about a year after that. With a special interferometer that you built for that purpose. And what was the main thrust of that? What was the approach that you were trying to figure out what was going on?
We're trying to do two things. One was, of course, to pin down the synoptic behavior. And the other, we deliberately built the array with cross dipoles so we could see the circular polarization.
Was that an analogy with solar bursts that you thought it might be circularly polarized?
Yeah, that is, knowing the solar bursts were circularly polarized was obvious. You wanted to check on the same possibility with the Jupiter bursts, because they did turn out to be strongly circularly polarized.
And what about the system periodicity? Shane's paper came out at a very early stage, showing a rotation period.
Shane's paper showed a rotation period that was clearly tied to the closely to system 2. And that was presented to the scientific public at the same meeting that our results were presented, because we had sent a letter to him saying that we found it, and that he may as well have the Jupiter noise in his records. So he,
now, which meeting is this? The Manchester?
This is the Manchester meeting in 1995.
I see. And did you go to that personally?
Yeah, I was there, and our data had been distributed ahead of time. I remember that I think it was Dewhurst gave a comment that our data showed that it fitted system 1. We didn't think you could do anything that good and not try to do any statistics. Of course, the Australian data showed clearly it was close to system 2, and when the journal, when the colloquium volume came out, Dewhurst had expunged his remarks on system 1.
I was just reviewing that this morning, indeed. Yeah. It says, Dewhurst, I can find no periodicity.
Right, that's not what he said at the meeting.
But was it just a matter of time base that enabled the...
Yeah, that is, we had single-point measurements as it transited through the Mills Cross, whereas if you have an interferometer that follows it for an hour or two a day, then right, you get a much better sample. And that's why we built an interferometer that deliberately was designed with dipoles north-south, cross dipoles, one north-south dipoles, the other east-west, but the array running north-south so that it had a broad pattern east-west so we could get a good record of the synoptic behavior. And I think that three of us in the world came to the realization that system 3
As it came to be known.
As it came to be known. We did not call it System 3. All we did was point out that another rotation period, other than the System 2 period, fitted our data much better. And, of course, at the same time, Roger Galley and the Florida group had also come to the same conclusion. So.
Was that some puzzlement, or were you willing to accept another one if you had two already?
Sure. Yeah. That is, it was clear that there was an atmospheric component in the rotation. The general feeling that all of us, I think, had was that the System 3 was more likely to be tied to the planet itself.
Oh, I see. It was somehow more firmly rooted.
Well, we could see that there was strong circular polarization, which meant there was a magnetic field, and the magnetic field is certainly more a measure of the solid body, or solid may not be quite the right word, but
it has to be tied to something.
The entity that we call Jupiter, if there's a magnetic field there, There may be shearing motions inside Jupiter itself, but they have a much longer time range than the things that you see in the cloud.
I guess that's right. This evidence really is the first of a magnetic field on Jupiter.
Yeah.
Although one would have suspected it, but
sure.
There was no spectroscopic evidence.
Right? No, that is, I think that we probably did have the first evidence for me.
Did you contact optical astronomers and try to set up any sort of joint programs? It would seem like a...
Yes, at a very early stage, we were in contact with Richardson.
Caltech.
The joint observations never showed much, and of course, in retrospect, it's clear that they didn't have much chance of doing so. But we obviously, the first thing we wanted to do was to see if there were some connections with visible features in the cloud bank. This is in the very earliest stages, and Richardson did do some simultaneous observations that coincided with our.
Mm-hmm.
And before the system 3 rotation came up, we were trying very hard to see what feature on the planet could be responsible for a while. It looked like it was a red spot, and then, of course, the Australians had seen some white spots, or seen that it corresponded to some white spots that were along the line. But it was in retrospect that it didn't mean much.
Well, you continue this kind of work for a year or two.
Yeah.
With this specially built interferometer.
Yeah, it was, as I remember, it was about 2 years.
And I wanted to ask about the role of Ken Franklin. He was not an electronics man.
No, he came from Berkeley with a background in astronomy and joined in on the work.
Was it a PhD in astronomy? Or?
Yeah, he had a PhD in astronomy. He did his thesis on Capella.
I see. So just stellar astronomy.
Yeah.
And but how would you characterize your different contributions to the Jupiter work?
Oh well, the designing and building the equipment clearly was the thing I did. We both worked together on the analysis of the data. And, Ken was still, although he wasn't technically an expert, he was quite happy to work very hard in the field on the,
mm-hmm.
on the repetitive hard work of getting antennas built and
right.
put up.
Was there any...
We worked just genuinely together.
Right. Because he was a traditional astronomer, was there any special advantage to that, since this was a classical astronomical object?
No, I don't think so. No, it was somebody who knew the ways of science and joined in and knew how to work with people. He was a very easy person to work with.
Well, what was the basic reason you stopped this? I mean, the work continued in Florida and many other places for several years thereafter.
I suppose that the event probably that had the most effect was the fact of Howard Taylor's death.
Which I happen to have seen was in late 57.
That's right.
I can date that.
Yeah. The 60-foot telescope was just about to be erected at Derwent. The multi-channel hydrogen receiver, which I had occasionally used just joining in with Tabel on his work, but not very deeply, that was completed. Clearly was in working order. And so when Tatel died, I took a much more active role
in that project, yeah. I see.
So that's why I would say that rather than to say I lost interest in the Jupiter radiation, I'd say that my interest in 21 centimeter work picked up. The Mills Cross was not very useful. We're pretty well established that the lack of a nice uniform ground plane gave it enough uncertainty in its pattern so that you really couldn't look for weak sources. You could see strong sources just fine, but to go after very weak sources, it's very hard to tell the difference between what was real and what was just an artifact, a silent pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And So we shift in, well, the solar activity was picking up, and so the 22 megahertz band was becoming much more filled with interference. So the motion went away from the, we moved away from that particular kind of work.
In fact, I think it's correct, isn't it, that there was nothing published from the Mills Cross except for this Jupiter discovery? And a couple odd things like but no real survey.
There was no proper survey. We looked at a few well-known sources. We established that we could phase it around and look at well-known sources. Looking for weak sources down in noise, it wasn't really.
But now, you said there wasn't a sufficiently accurate ground plane. Was this because of not a flat enough field, or?
Well, the field was plenty flat, but we didn't put down a metallic screen. We just relied on the conductivity of the ground. And changes seasonally, and we're not buried with a lot of water.
So you just felt that it wasn't worth the effort to upgrade it to that
extent. Right. And it was a lot of work maintaining the thing, because it was built on a very minimum budget, and maintenance was getting to be a pretty big load. Those dipoles would fall down, and cows would come in and chew on the twin lead. And, so it was a combination of many things. We built another antenna at about that same time, roughly 1957. That was when Bill Erickson came to the Carnegie Institution. And Bill and I built a long V-type antenna, where the aim of our project was to measure some accurate positions of radio sources at 400 megahertz. And of course, we built it much more ruggedly so that we didn't have to worry much about cows and broken wires. But I think that the
was
dominant...
That the, was that the corner reflector?
The corner reflector, And I think that what happened as time went by, it looked as though the scientific paper really lay with 21 centimeters at that period. Mm-hmm. So that increasingly became something that I was more active in.
So you more or less just left the low frequency
work.
When you brought up the name of Howard Tatel, could I just ask, what was this the first radio astronomy that he'd gotten involved in? This dish and the channel receiver and so forth?
I think that he became involved in radio astronomy roughly in 1952.
When Tube got enthusiastic.
Did Tube describe to you how he got the receiver?
Well, he probably did. It's been many years now, to be honest.
That is, this is all secondhand. That is, Tube was visiting at Harvard and was an old friend of Purcell.
Oh, yes.
I think he probably told you the story. Anyway, he got Purcell's old receiver.
And, in fact, Doc Ewan has told me.
Yeah.
Now I know, yes.
And at the same time, he got a giant Wurzburg antenna from Eurus Andes, I suppose. I'm not sure. And they built a homebrew mount for it. And when I arrived, the system was just barely working, and they were in the process of replacing various elements of Ewan's receiver with more reliable, more modern.
Right. Let me just ask, that Wurzburg, there's a standard picture of it that shows it right in the back of some standard American houses. Where was that actually located?
It was located on the back lawn of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism.
Right in Broad Branch Road?
Right at the Broad Branch Road location, right in downtown Washington.
I didn't know if that was Tube's house or...
Those were...
Just neighbors.
Those are neighbors. They're not... the houses you probably saw were not neighbors' houses at all. There's one building that is a low-frame building that was built as an anti-magnetic, non-magnetic building. And that's probably what made you think it was a neighbor.
Perhaps, okay. Yeah. Anyway, it was right at the side.
Yeah.
So Tatel never did get involved in observations then, because of his death.
He became involved in observations with the Wurzburg. There was a couple of publications. Larry Helfer was one of the authors, in which they published profiles through the galaxy at a particular longitude from plus minus 5 degrees or so. And actually, that was some of the data that I used to, when I looked at their maps and saw that the outermost arms did not lie in the plane, And I took a look at all of their data, plus whatever data had been published by the Australians and the Dutch, and realized that it was in the same sense as a tidal deformation of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find that. There it is. It was a AAAS talk in late 56.
That's right.
The first mention. Yeah. That you had of that. So that did use some of that Hertzberg H1 data as well as the...
Yeah, there was H1 data from the Hertzberg by that time.
But I guess it was felt that something bigger was needed than the Hertzberg, something that could steer better and so forth. And
It steered well enough, but it's something with better angular resolution. Originally, they hoped to build an 84-foot here, but didn't have enough money for it, so the 60-foot was the compromise. And that was designed largely by Table, with two taking a very active role.
Mm-hmm.
And actual construction didn't start until after Table had died.
What was Table's background? Was he a physicist?
He was a physicist who worked with two at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab.
I see.
And then eventually joined two as sort of his right-hand man. He was Tube's foil, his principal foil.
And let me just ask about Helfer. What was his background?
Okay, Larry Helfer and I arrived at Carnegie Institution at the same time in the fall of 1953. And he came as a theorist from doing his thesis under Chandra Sekhar.
I see.
So the two of us were put together in the same room with the hope that we'd stimulate one another. And
so his forte was in theoretical matters.
Yeah. But he became interested in observing at that time. He became very active in the observing program.
Okay, that ends talking with Bernie Burke on 22nd September 1981.